Miss Rheingold? Where are you tonight, Miss Rheingold? With your nervous gang, running back and forth on the beach, carrying wicker baskets, looking manically forever into the sun with the great ocean endlessly, ceaselessly lashing out at the eternal shore. Miss Rheingold, where are you tonight? Oh, old friendly winemaker, where are you tonight in your leather pants? The one who makes the wine so mellow. Jack Parr, where gone, lost, where tonight are you? What's Loretta Young doing this minute? And please, please, oh Princess Grace, where are you tonight? Who can shake the scales of existence from the hide of life itself? Oh, Miss Rheingold, don't forsake us. Keep that party somehow going. We need you, you know. And Carol Reed, are you still having a happy? I hope, oh, my God, I hope you are. Because if you're not, none of us are. Norman Vincent Peale, are your glasses still clean and bright and shiny and glistening there? Standing in that soft, muted light of the stained glass? Oh, American life. Oh, existence. Oh, time. Oh, trial. Oh, Nathan. With your mustard. Don't. Please don't. It's all part of it. You've got to hold on and cling. J.D. Salinger and the lost and gone epics of an eternal youth, always playing, always hoping, always wishing, always feeling that the next moment it'll work out. Oh, yes, I know that sound well. In the ancient lakes of the long lost, inverted bowl of the eternal Midwest. Yes, in the rocky northern shores of old New England itself. Oh, Miss Rheingold. Oh, interwoven pair. Gone forever from the scene. Pick and pap. Yes. We're all in it together. Each one of us here, rocking in our great big candy boat. You know, we've got a tradition. We have a tradition here in America. Yes, we have. Oh, Daddy Warbucks. You really can't tell when a Borneo native's hung up. I'm just sitting there about, oh, it was about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning in the television set. They got this television set that comes on very, very late once in a while. I think that's the thing. That's the thing that is going to, I suppose, in the way, draw us all together. The sight of the innumerable American faces looking out at us, selling innumerable American things. That girl that comes into the apartment with the decorator, and she has those napkins in the box that does not have advertising on it. You know, there's a kind of warm feeling of victory somehow. Something has been surmounted. I'm watching a movie that means nothing to me. I'm watching this old movie, and suddenly Mr. Clean comes on the screen. An old friend appears. Have you noticed that Clean is beginning to... He sold out to the Fuzz. Fuzz Fink. Riding around in that squad car. What is it he's got? Is it the Grime Fighters he's got? I think it's the Grime Fighters. And who's that old guy who comes around and talks about that stuff that has deep cleaning power? You know that lecherous old janitor or whatever he is that's always standing out in front of that apartment house putting up a sign, and that lady says, whatever his name is, well, now you come in here and do something to my sink immediately. The girls are coming. And he shows up and he gives her that fly wink.
and he takes out that stuff with the deep cleaning powder. I feel much more involved in those people than I do in Priscilla Lane and Dick Ireland and Chester Morris and all that. Oh, American life. It's like the other day, you know, American life is a very direct life. You, there's nothing, you cannot come to an American and have something going on behind what you say.
He takes you at your absolute word. Like the other night, I'm on the air, and I'm talking about this Jack Lemmon story in Life magazine where it says, Jack Lemmon's chief problem is, does anybody like me? And I have this music playing behind me, and I'm saying, but me, does anybody like me? And let me tell you, there must have been 450 people who immediately says, I'll write him a letter and tell him I like him. Now, it wasn't very nice of you, Mr. Shepard, to ask us so directly. You just can't be that way with him. You've got to be absolutely on the surface, right there. It's like, have you seen that scene in Miss Rheingold there when they're all running around on that yacht and she's catching that fish? Have you seen that one, that commercial? Oh, of course you have. It's a little drama there. Miss Rheingold's catching that big fish, and they're all running back. And that old coot comes out with a couple of, he's got a couple of cans of beer, and he makes the thing with the binoculars. Oh, there's a lot more going on that yacht than just beer drinking. I'll tell you that. It's just in the air. You can just feel it. You know, it's in the air. I don't know. And then there's the scene where this guy is walking, come running up the beach, you know, with this other chick. And two chicks and the thing and the dog is barking. He comes running up and all of a sudden you see the waves and there's a package of cigarettes there caught right there in the driftwood. And there's a little talk there, a little thing going on. And there's a lot more going on that beach than just smoking cigarettes. I mean, you don't get that look in the eye from just smoking those cigarettes. I've watched millions of people smoke cigarettes and they don't get that ecstatic. Tastes the way they ought to should. Oh, no, there's something else going on there. And it's all part and parcel of the American night. 4 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Clean is jumping into his squad car. Woo! Off he goes. It's part of the American night. It's part of the dream. It's part of what we're living in. Next one, Eddie. Next one. All set. Next one. Speaking of the American dream, we're packaging our world, you know, and somehow, another one. The other night, speaking of how you cannot get oblique with American audiences. The other night, I'm talking about the thing with the names, you know, the company, the big outfit that has designed these new dial systems, has also installed in the government a whole new deal whereby everybody's going to get a number. And I'm saying how great that's going to be. I receive 45 letters from people saying, Mr. Shepard, that's terrible. That's a rotten idea. Oh, please, please, please. But we're all in it. We're all in it. I don't know. Have you ever been down to Texas? Well, let me tell you about Texas just briefly. I was in Texas for a week or two last summer, swinging all over the state. And Texas is everything that America is going to be in 10 years. It's always about 10 years ahead of us down there. It really is. You know, we think it's behind us ahead. Oh, much, much more so. That's always true of the frontier, you know. People go out there and they don't have any preconceptions. They don't drag anything behind. And they start up with that new brave look in the eye that is boundless. The landscape is boundless and so is the view. And so we have a thing from Dallas. Have you ever been to Dallas? Oh, Dallas is an insane city. Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, really. I mean, if you think Jersey and the pizzas and the instant seat cover syndrome is something, you should go down to Texas, Dallas down there. Oh, boy. We have a note from Dallas. And the thing about most of the insane things we do is we do them with a vague sense of a kind of successful thing. It's like we have done something good again. Well, Mama, we've done it again. We have made the scene. I quote to you now from the Teacher's Trading Post. When the din of young voices in higher school cafeteria, Highland Park Schools, Dallas, Texas, becomes deafening, a buzzer sounds, a red signal light flashes, and silence falls. Clatter and chatter subside, a yellow light follows, and the children begin to talk again, but softly, When the green light blinks on, the children start talking in their normal voices. All the children are controlled by colored lights. Oh, boy. I don't know. What is it? What is it about that little news item, just a simple little news item, that makes little things go up and down by your shoulder blades? You know, there's a kind of sense in that item as though, you know, gee whiz, if we work hard enough, we'll cure all the problems. You know, America's based on an interesting premise. It really is. It's based on the premise that anything that we have, we can control. And anything that can be controlled is good. It's also based on another kind of premise. So it's very, very, this is probably the most difficult premise of all that we have to continually fight our way through. That we know what the condition of man is. There have been 1,000 authors who have written about it. America is based on the premise that there is an alternative. just to remind us. Just to remind us how it is down there. It's like this picture. It comes out of the Long Island Press. There's an old duffer who has white hair, has a white beard, looks exactly like Uncle Sam. He's got an Uncle Sam beard, you know, the kind that sticks out aggressively, and he's wearing a pair of blue overalls. And he's got the clear light of the man who has a mission in his eyes. It's shining out. And this picture shows him standing in front of a gigantic ball of string. And it says, the string's run out on Luke Roberts, 86-year-old Douglas, Nebraska farmer. He started saving twine years ago and twice won second place with it in the county fair hobby show. He says there's over 46 miles in the 3-foot-wide ball. Only trouble is now Luke can't get it to fit through the door. He's got. There is a tremendous feeling of it's beginning to settle like a kind of fallout over the industrial world that we live in. It's a 20th century, I suppose you can call it an industrial era syndrome, and it's a slow drifting fallout, a kind of ash, a noiseless, tasteless, invisible ash of boredom that is the natural result of the final victory, I suppose you might say, or maybe it's our final defeat due to total automation or total industrialization or urbanization of life. It's drifting down. And there are many, many symptoms. For example, did you notice the Academy Awards, a good example of that? This is the time of the gigantic motion picture, the enormous picture. I mean, the bigger the picture, the longer the picture, the more expensive the picture, the obvious winner it's got to be. I predict already now, right now, before we hear you, you hear it here first, next year's Academy Award winner will be Cleopatra. It has to be. Nobody's seen it, but it's got to be. It's the most expensive picture in history. It's got to win the prizes. The biggest, widest, most insane picture will always win, regardless of whether or not it's a bad picture. It's an in-between. It doesn't make any difference. It's the longest picture. It's got to go. And so this is part of the problem of boredom. You know, many, many years ago, like 3,000 years ago, people were concerned with the problem of boredom, and particularly people who were running various countries and were philosophers involved in the running of various countries. There was an old idea about circuses, that when people get bored, the circus is always the out. It is an out. And after a certain length of time, I'm curious what happens after a civilization has passed through the circus era. Now, providing it can continue itself, providing it can sustain itself, what happens then? The circus era of entertainment and an attempt to ward off boredom is always a passing phase. We are in it now. We are in it. Our movies are gigantic. They're widescreen. The bigger the screen, the better the picture. I'm sure that how the West was won is just the beginning. It's not the end of Westerns. It's the start of the big Westerns. We haven't even seen the big ones yet. Wait till they move the entire population of Utah onto the screen. They will follow. They will follow every Conestoga wagon west. It'll have to be. It just will have to be. We started with biblical epics, and now we are on the verge of the gigantic Western epic. How the West was won is only a beginning. It's just a very. They've just nibbled at the edge of that one. You just wait and see. If you think you can, you've seen big ones, we've just started. And of course, in Rome, they worked out some pretty good ones too, a couple of thousand years ago. Oh yes, they did. I remember standing right there by the great arch, leading into the Roman Forum. Standing right there, you could see the grooves where the chariots came in. Yeah, you can see right in the stone there. It's a very eerie thing, and you can see hanging up over one of the hills. You see the edge of the Colosseum. And at twilight, it is one of the absolutely unforgettable sights in all of the world. Absolutely. Is to be up on one of the hills above what is left of the Forum. Just look down there, and you can see it all spread out with that peculiar Roman twilight. They have a strange twilight that is a sort of an orange-gold, vaguely greenish cast. It doesn't look like any American twilight I've ever seen. I suppose there's there has to be a different air there. It's a different part of the world. And you get a different feeling. And everything is in silhouette as far as you can see around you. You can see a few poplar trees sticking up and a few gigantic statues just hanging up over the Roman sky that were put up during Benito's days. And there in that great depression it is, just laying out there. Century after century, peeled layer after layer after layer, and circus after circus after circus. Now, what happens after the circuses? Well, now, that's an interesting problem. Now, there aren't many countries at all who have survived that long, that have had the circuses and then have receded to something else. Now, boredom is always a problem. It's always a problem in human life. It has nothing to do with the emptiness of values. So don't immediately leap up, oh, we had a values. No, no. They have fought boredom where values are as solid as the best ebony and concrete. They have still had that problem. It is just part of our existence. I guess it's because we're a self-conscious creature. Rabbits are not. Dogs are not. Man is. I think boredom is a product of self-consciousness. We got very philosophical here tonight. But what they do in many countries, or have in certain countries, you have to go to places that are much older than our culture to see what has happened when the circuses have disappeared. For example, about 1,000 years ago in the Far East, in China, they were in the middle of their circus period. So was Japan. The circus period was the Greek period of the fantastic warrior cults that provided the circuses for the people who lived at that time. And the circuses were great. I suppose many of you have read Chinese history of the periods and realize that they went through many of the same things that we have gone through. Well, then what happens after the people, after all of us? What happens after we tire of the gigantic widescreen epics? You know, we've only been in the era of the circus for a comparatively short time, historically speaking. Maybe 100 years, perhaps, is about the length of time we've been involved in it. That's a short time. That's just two or three lifetimes. It's a very short time, historically speaking. And so what happens after the circus? Well, what they often do is people begin to get involved in exactly the reverse of the circus. They get, but yet with the same values. You follow me there? Instead of 87,000 people meeting in a gigantic plane with battle flags flying, with armor crashing, with horses whinnying, with catapults booming off, with the bastion being stormed, which is the circus of England, they'll go exactly the opposite direction, but maintain the same value. Apparently, conflict is a necessary thing among men. Conflict is necessary because no matter what culture you find, you will find there are many forms of conflict. For example, in the most civilized societies, or men, we will have the totally abstract conflict. Let's say chess. This is conflict. It is conflict of a high order, but don't forget for one minute, it is conflict. As a matter of fact, one of the most angry men I know, one of the most competitive men I know, and a man who frankly will tell you he hates most of mankind, is a famous chess player who is a friend of mine. He uses chess to kill people. Literally. He does. And there's a fierce anger that burns in him, and the fiercer his anger, the more ferocious a chess player he is. Plays all over the world. Famous chess player, a listener, by the way. And the only time he's really brilliant is when he wants to kill this guy. And he can't do it artificially. Like one of the most famous games played in modern chess was played by this guy on one night when he defeated the then world champion because of a backstage slight which he thought that he had suffered. And he walked out, he says, "I'll smash him." And he walked out into the arena and he killed this guy in probably the most ignominious way that chess people can ever kill. Just pow, it's like Joe Louis walking out and hitting Max Schmeling. In 2 minutes and 7 seconds of the first round, he went down and was in the hospital for the next year. You know, that kind of a defeat. Well, that's what this guy did. So don't tell me that conflict is not, you know, chess, it's not. Yes, there are many ways to kill a man. Now the idea of conflict takes many forms. And I ran across an article. Just somebody sent me a little, a beautiful essay. You don't read the essay form much in the newspapers any longer. But here's an essay from an out-of-town newspaper by a man named Russell Baker. And I'm going to read this essay to you because it's about conflict and about a society that did something about what happens. I say that probably in 1,000 years we will have a variation of this. My sinister oriental music, please, Eddie. Yeah, the blue one. That's it. This is the ancient world. I wish I had some good Chinese music to this. But this is an essay by a man named Russell Baker, Dateline Washington. And like all good writers, Mr. Baker is not necessarily talking about what he seems to be discussing. Washington, April 3rd. Everyone who is alarmed about the imminent abolition of boxing should be rereading Bertold Laufer's 1927 classic, Insect Musicians and Cricket Champions of China. Here in 27 beautiful, calm pages of scholarly prose and 12 photogravure plates is the thrilling answer to the question, after boxing, what? The answer is cricket fighting. The sport which has fulfilled the Chinese need for vicarious violence since the Sung Dynasty nearly 1,000 years ago. As the reader turns these pages in mounting excitement, he senses that cricket fighting is not merely the logical replacement for boxing, but very likely the ultimate American sport for the late 20th century. It requires no human exertion. Unless one counts the finger movements involved in using a cricket tickler to encourage the tame palookas to mix it up. It is ideally suited for television, having only two insects in a jar to focus upon. The camera is unlikely to miss much action, as it does in baseball, football, and boxing. And finally, when magnified to fill a theater screen with closed-circuit TV, a good cricket fight should look fierce enough to satisfy the most jaded sports fan. Quote from the great classic, two rivals will jump at each other's heads with furious bites, and the combat will usually end in the death of one of the fighters. It frequently happens that the victor devours the body of his adversary. If cricket fighting becomes popular in this country, Laufer's work will surely be regarded as the Bible of the sport. Its publisher, the Field Museum of History in Chicago, is making it available at the absurd price of 50 cents the copy. Though Laufer generously acknowledged his debt to Kai Sei Tao, the 13th century author of the definitive Tzu Chi King, the Book of Crickets, his own work provides all the raw information anyone may need to promote local cricket fights. How, one may ask, are crickets introduced to the game? How does one train a cricket? They are usually captured in the evening, says Laufer. He recommends placing a lighted candle in front of a cricket hole and holding a box trap in readiness. Attracted by the light, the insects hop out of their retreats and are finally caught in the traps made of bamboo or ivory rods. When Laufer studied the game in China in 1927, even small-time cricket promoters kept huge stables, maintaining several rooms full of jars, each containing a single fighting cricket. The rich hired experts to handle diet, health, and training routine. As soon as you enter a house like this, you are greeted with a deafening noise, which a Chinese is able to stand for any length of time, Laufer noted in his great book. Diet is relatively simple. Fighters between bouts get a dish, quote, of rice mixed with fresh cucumbers, boiled chestnuts, lotus seeds, and mosquitoes. When training starts, quote, they get a tonic in the form of a bouillon made from the root of a certain flower. Some sporting owners, he reports, allow themselves to be stung by mosquitoes, and when these are full of blood, throw them to the crickets in order to stir their ferocity prior to a bout. Laufer advises crickets, quote, must be compelled to fast to train. He is profligate with tips on how to recognize a good fighter. Here's how you recognize a good cricket fighter. Loud chirping, big head, neck, long legs, broad body and back. And how to keep a cricket in fighting trim. If the crickets droop their tiny mustaches, they are too warm. Smoke is bad for them. Colds must be treated with a mosquito diet alone. Crickets sick with the heat should be fed shoots of the fresh green pea. And you want to hear now about the fights themselves. The battle. Yes. Oh, sing. We are now at the essence. We are now at the taste of conflict itself. Real conflict always involves the death of one or the other of the adversaries. A bullfight would not be a bullfight if a rubber saber were used. Oh, no. A war would not be a war if the bullets were of plastic. Somehow man craves that taste of death. And now the bout itself. They are held in jars or bowls. The referee must have a cricket tickler made of a few rat or rabbit whiskers inserted in a reed, bone, or ivory handle. And after, quote, announcing the contestants and reciting the history of their past performances and victories, he must then stir them to fight by tickling their heads, their tails, and their hind legs. Laufer describes a typical match as follows, and we quote, the two opponents, thus excited, stretch out their antennae and jump at each other's heads. The antennae or tentacles are their chief weapons. One of the belligerents will soon lose one of its horns, while the other may retort by tearing off one of its enemy's legs. The two combatants become more and more exasperated. The struggle usually ends in the death of one of them, and it occurs not infrequently that the more agile or stronger one pounces with its whole weight upon the body of its opponent, completely severing its head. course, as Baker points out, the big problem of developing the game in this country is easily foreseeable. A lot of spoil sports are going to try to keep it off television until after the children's bedtime. Have you ever seen a cricket fight? Well, not only that, you see, since we, of course, are spectacle-minded, we could hardly at this point draw ourselves away from the New York football giants and the Green Bay Packers and watch something as brutally primal as that. However, I suspect Baker is right. That within 50 or 75 years, there will be a version of that. Maybe even, maybe a little longer than that, I'd say. Perhaps maybe 100, 150 years. Now, do you know anything about cricket musicians or insect musicians? This is an exquisite form of aesthetic thrill that many of the older civilizations have evolved. The tiring of gigantic street bands, tiring of 300-piece orchestras with gigantic cymbals, enormous bass fiddles, tiring of stereo. A group of trainers grew up about 1,000 years ago in central China who trained musicians to provide music for the household. For example, a cricket of particularly melodious song was bred to another cricket of exquisite song, until finally a race of singing crickets was developed. Now, how do they treat a singing cricket? Have you ever seen a little cricket cage? Have you ever seen them? Well, the cricket cage is generally hung, usually near what corresponds to the hearth in a Chinese house. And the cricket, usually at eventide, being what it is, a creature of obviously complete instinct, will invariably begin to sing at certain times of the day. And usually that certain time of the day is as the day grows to a close. The cricket begins to sing. It is an extremely pleasant thing. And the cricket is fed cucumbers. He is fed just like any other pet and is as proudly kept as any other pet. And there are other singing insects, too, not only the cricket. There are dozens of other types of insects which are trained to sing. And, I'm not putting you down or putting you on. This is the truth. It also fits a country which is quite old and also is getting poor. It's much easier to sustain a cricket than it is, say, the New York football giants. They eat a lot less. And there are many other things which I feel that will probably eventually happen after we have gone through the giant era of the enormous pageant. If you've gone through recently any one of the museums that particularly the Museum of Modern Art or any one of the modern galleries, you will find that most modern paintings are in one shape or another a genuine circus. They're not paintings, really. They are circuses. The first thing you can tell about a circus is its obvious physical size. This is important to a circus. A small circus is a non-circus for a circus-conscious society. Just as in our society today, a small painting is not a painting. What we want are circuses. And so the larger the painting, generally, the more it is esteemed. Until finally you get paintings in the Museum of Modern Art that will cover, really, some of them are a story and a half tall. Literally, a story and a half tall. If you take a story as being 11 feet high, which is what an architect generally will consider a story. Some of them are 15 feet high and 30 feet across, a painting. So the sheer physicality of them, the sheer size of them is enough. If you take a piece of canvas, do you know anything about canvas? I'll tell you. You take a piece of plain, ordinary canvas that's 15 feet high and 30 feet across, you will stand in front of it in awe. I'll tell you that, just from the sheer size. Yes, you will. Now, if you take that same sheet of canvas and paint it entirely black, I'll give you a suggestion if you want to be a painter. Just paint it entirely black. And take one large can of yellow paint and make a great yelling, screaming, orange-red swirl in the upper left-hand corner of a 15-foot-high canvas, 30 feet across, and call it the firmament, Dad, you are going to be hung. I've just suggested a painting for you. Seriously. The sheer physicality of it will do it every time. It's the circus world we're living in, and I'm not immediately, everybody says, ah, there's that square. You're putting me. No, I'm not putting modern painting down. I'm merely describing a part of our whole world. Everything is part and parcel of the same thing. You can't escape it. We can't escape the elephantiasis that runs through almost everything we do, whether it's the elephantiasis of the automobiles. Speaking of that, I heard it. I finally did hear it, and I'm sure that you heard it too. There is a there's a company today advertising on the air the largest compact on the road. Yeah. So elephantiasis has even been affecting the dwarf world. So it's going. We are in a circus. We want circuses, and we are part of a circus. Our life is a circus generally today. It's very hard to keep up. Have you looked at most newspapers? I think that the 6 weeks that we had, how long was it? 100 days, 110 days off from the newspapers, really, in a sense, detached us from the circus for a while. And now the circus has returned, just like that. And I was hit the first two or three days, reading the tabloids particularly, the enormous Colosseum-like aspect of our view of the world. Gigantic headline. Sybil gets $1.5 million from Dickey. It's as though the world is a gigantic family, and everybody knows everybody else, and we're all arguing over whether Sybil and Dickey should split and make the same. Do you know that there is a magazine currently, a film magazine currently, that has what they call their big divorce guide? Yes, it is a magazine. This it has its divorce guide. It has about 15 pages of pictures of people, so that not about who is married to who, but who is divorcing whom, and when did who divorce what and how. It is a divorce guide. It is a gigantic divorce issue guide, a special one for you spectacle fans out there. It's all part of the circus. You see, circuses take many forms. There's the sex circus. There's the scandal circus. There is the anger circus. Oh, yes. You know, there's the indignation circus. There is the tolerance circus. There is the peace circus. There are many kinds of circuses going on. And whatever circus you happen to be involved in is usually not considered a circus by you. There is the art circus. There is the television circus. There is the magazine circus. Of course, there's the political circus, and that goes on and on and on and on. And then there's the biggest one of all, and that's the world circus. We have the clowns, and we have the good guys, we have the bad guys, we have the straight men, we have the pie-in-the-face men, we have the villains, we have the in-between men, we have the featured players, the bit players, we have countries which form villain countries, we have good guy countries, we have bad guy countries, we have in-between countries, we have sneaky countries, and we have the clowns, we have the bears, we have the skating, waltzing deer. And look for heaven's sake, look at the seals, there's McMillan, look at that, it's Ike. Yeah, we got the circuses, we got the big top, we got them swinging and hollering, we got the trapeze artists, we got the guys blowing the horns, and then here I am selling a popcorn, a big popcorn for all of you, popcorn for each and every one of you. Wake up a bag of popcorn for the kiddies before you go into the big show.